My name is Caleb Bailey, and I am a reporter with the podcast The World and Everything in It, which is with World News Group. And our editor recommended speaking to you because your book, Pro-Life Answers to Pro-Choice Questions, has been recommended on our podcast multiple times. And so I did get the chance to read most of the book throughout this afternoon. I formulated questions based on the chapters, not every chapter necessarily. In the intro, you speak at length about learning to listen and the benefit of listening. Our audience obviously is pro-life primarily, and hopefully there will be some pro-choice in that audience. On both sides, what advantage is there to listen well and engage in conversation with an opposing viewpoint?
Well, I think one of the huge problems in our culture, and it has just gotten worse in the last several years with all the fights about the elections and obviously COVID, and people have a profound inability anymore, it seems, to really listen to what other people are saying. And so what you end up with is dialogues of the deaf, which is no dialogue at all. I mean, nobody's really hearing. Everybody's formulating their next response. You see this when you see people engaging in supposed debates on TV where they're not even paying attention to what the other person is saying. They're just formulating, okay, this is what I plan to say next, and now I'm going to say it. I actually believe that the majority of pro-choice people are not in favor of child killing. I don't believe that in their hearts and in their minds and in their consciences that they really want to kill babies. Now, I have been in this battle surrounding this issue for many, many years, including working with pregnancy resource centers, the first one in the Pacific Northwest, as a pastor preaching on the subject and dealing with people, going out to abortion clinics for peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience, as well as also legal protests preceding that, and been involved in political efforts. So, I mean, those are all great, but what I'm saying is I know what I'm talking about in terms of people not listening to each other, and also, I think, stigmatizing each other from the get-go so that we feel like we're not really talking to a rational human being. And so one of the things that I said early on in the book is that I think we share in common the ability to, the evidence is the same for all of us. Now, we tend to be very selective in gathering it according to our own biases. But we also have a rational ability to look at things. For instance, I believe that a person who is intelligent, and many, and there are many intelligent people that aren't college educated, obviously, and many college educated that aren't intelligent, I guess I could add that too. But I have seen again and again pro-choice people who, when I sit down with them and present the actual, okay, here's the scientific evidence. This is a 3D, 4D ultrasound. Does it appear to you that this baby who's sucking his thumb, yawning, stretching, does it appear to you that that is a human being? Well, yeah, it does. And I said, do you think your appearances are deceiving you? I mean, just because the baby is located inside a mother's womb, does that change who that is? Will moving it 18 inches outside, so now outside the womb, and suddenly this baby's life is sacred and matters, and this is really a human being. So they become a human being in the few minutes that it takes to get outside, and they weren't a human being before. And I find that many people who call themselves pro-choice are capable of changing their minds. But if we only call them names, then I feel like we tend to lose our audience. And so that's why I'm trying to appeal also to pro-choice people. Also, there are so many middle-of-the-road people. There are so many people that are sort of pro-life, but ultimately pro-choice. And then so many people who say they're pro-choice and would never say they're pro-life. And yet, if you say, are you in favor of life? Well, yeah. I mean, they're pro-life for almost everybody, maybe not unborn children. So you appeal to them and say, so what is it about unborn children that makes you feel like they shouldn't be protected? So we can reason with each other. I really think we can. Now, there is a spiritual darkness surrounding this issue, obviously. And I know this firsthand from court cases, judges coming unhinged, yelling at pro-life defendants, being totally unreasonable. So I get that. Like Pages Out or Frank Peretti's This Present Darkness and, you know, things like that. But for the most part, I think people are capable of listening and hearing. And I think we need to assume the best of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll jump right into the chapters. It seems like, and I might just be assuming here, but you strategically structure the book because as people bring up different arguments, whether it's rights or it's the rare instances of rape and incest or it's abnormalities, it all comes down to the matter of personhood. Right. Of what makes a person, what makes a human, what makes a living, viable human inside the womb. And so before we jump into defining any of that and talking about how you work through that in your book, why is personhood the central piece?
Well, because if this is not really a person, if it is what used to be called a blob of tissue, a product of conception, and there's no humanity involved, then it's just a piece of tissue, a part of your body like anything else. And if you have something that needs to be removed because it's cancerous or that needs to be dealt with or corrected or, you know, different parts of your body are expendable when they're not helping you and they're even bringing harm to you. So if this is all this is, a parasite, as it's sometimes called by pro-choice advocates, uninvited into the body. No, the woman wasn't asking to get pregnant. She's pregnant now. And if this isn't a human being, then there are no human rights issues. But the big problem then is the demonstrably true fact that the unborn child has its own distinctive DNA, completely distinct from the mother's. Now, the child will have gotten some DNA from the mother and some from the father, and this will be a unique combination, unlike any in history. And every single cell with its own different DNA cries out, I am not the same as my mother. I am inside my mother's body, but I am not a part of my mother's body. I am myself a distinct human being. And that's the simple scientific reality. And a lot of pro-choice advocates, to their credit, are now admitting that that is true, that all the stuff that used to be said all the time, it's just a blob of tissue and all that, because the proof is so convincing. And so now they're saying, okay, yeah, so maybe that, call that an unborn child, I'd rather not, but maybe it has some rights, but it doesn't have as many rights as the mother does. But if it's not human, if it's not a person in any sense, then there's really no issue, there's no debate.
Absolutely. And we'll talk a little bit later about the issue of, discrimination in the sense of if that child has some rights, but not as many as the mother, well, what constitutes that? Because you could say that about anything outside of the womb.
Exactly.
Based off of race, off of gender, any of those. But we'll get to that because that was a later chapter. Something that stuck out in that first chapter was everything that happens in just the first trimester. For the listeners, could you, you know, talk through some of those big developmental landmarks for an infant in the womb in the first trimester?
So between 5 and 9 days after conception, the new person burrows into the womb's wall for safety and nourishment. Already his or her gender can be determined by scientific means. It will be 2 more weeks before clearly human features are discernible, and 3 more before they're obvious. At just 18 days after conception, the heart is forming and the eyes start to develop. By 21 days, the heart pumps blood throughout the body. By 28 days, the unborn baby has budding arms and legs. By 30 days, she has a brain and has multiplied in size 10,000 times. By 35 days, her mouth, ears, and nose are all taking shape. At 40 days, the preborn child's brain waves can be recorded, and her heartbeat, which began 3 weeks earlier, can be detected by an ultrasonic stethoscope. By 42 days, her skeleton is formed and her brain is controlling the movement of muscles and organs. And then I'll stop after 10 weeks, though I go on in the book. But by 8 weeks, hands and feet are almost perfectly formed. The 9-week baby has, quote, already perfected a somersault, backflip, and scissor kick. That's from a scientific source. The unborn child responds to stimulus and may already be capable of feeling pain. And then it goes on. But the reason I'm stopping there is because that's when the earliest abortions take place, at 8 weeks. So the earliest surgical abortions. If a woman is only 6 weeks pregnant, they will normally say, we're not doing the abortion, wait a couple of weeks. So we're talking about every child who is surgically aborted. Everything I just said is already true of.
Why is it that they don't, because I wasn't aware that 8 weeks is the earliest that they do it. Why is it that they wouldn't do it any earlier?
The child is so small at that point that there's a danger of leaving parts of it when they take it apart, of not seeing them, and those being left inside the body. So they always do an inventory of body parts after the abortion. And if it's too small, it would be easy for a little hand or a little foot or something like that to be left inside the mother, and then infection and the dangers of that.
Absolutely. So then on that topic and those different features and landmarks and stuff, all kinds of different states and different stances will define personhood based off of size, maybe heartbeat, in time within the pregnancy, and that's how some of this legislation has been put in place so far. Why are those arbitrary factors at one point?
Well, because I guess they're inherently arbitrary. I mean, how can you say at what point does something no longer something but someone? Well, it's got to be the point of fertilization where that new person with this new DNA that's never existed in human history has come together. So it's not just people will joke about, a man's sperm being a fast swimmer, you know, and getting to the egg and acting as if the egg and the sperm have their own personhood. They don't, of course. It's only when they are united together and you have this distinctively new DNA. Okay, because if it doesn't start there, then where do you say it starts? And certainly it's irrational to say that the beating heart and brain waves, and this is not a baby. And yet, the beating heart and the measurable brain waves are way before the earliest abortions. And so it just, I mean, a woman doesn't even know she's pregnant at the point where the brain waves and heartbeat are measurable, often doesn't know she's pregnant.
Gotcha. And then you also in that chapter, before we move on from that chapter, say that changing the meaning of words doesn't change reality. Can you give an example of that in this case?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, the terminology, because people don't like to talk about the unborn child as a child. They don't like to talk about a baby. And so they'll use the term embryo or fetus or product of conception. If you're just talking about a certain stage of development, embryo and fetus are fine to say, as long as you know that's a baby. But those words are used to replace baby and to undermine the sense of personhood. But the label that we put on it, the semantics don't matter. The point is this a never-before-existing human being that has its own unique DNA and which, if not killed, will grow into full personhood, and which every single person who has ever been born was at that stage before, and if they had been aborted at that stage, they would not exist today. And as long as we know that, then whatever term we want to use. But the problem is when people are in denial and they use these impersonal terms, which were used in Nazi Germany of the Jews, useless eaters, things like that, and just these labels that are put on people that demeans them and dehumanizes them. I was on a radio program years ago with a prominent pro-choice advocate, and she was saying, now, I want to make clear, some people say I'm pro-abortion. She says, I'm not pro-abortion. I just believe in a woman's right to choose. And I said, why are you uncomfortable with the term pro-abortion? She says, well, I just don't like to use it. I said, well, but tell me, I really don't understand. If abortion is perfectly fine, why are you uncomfortable with using that term? And she got very frustrated, and then all of a sudden it just came out of her mouth. Well, it's a tough thing to kill your baby. And as soon as she said it, it was like all the air was sucked out of the studio she was in. I mean, it was over the telephone that we're doing the interview, but I was like, she knew she had just trapped herself. She knew she had said the words you can never say. And so the moment you put the actual words to it, you show that's what I really believe. And people, whether they deny it or not, they know. They know this is a baby, because I remember a pro-choice advocate who was a former Senator Bob Packwood in Oregon, who was talking about he had, I don't know how many grandchildren, but it was like 4 grandchildren, and then the 5th is on the way and will be born in. Oh, you just called that a grandchild. I mean, if it's your grandchild, it's a child, right? And again, those things slip out, but yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, it's just like the truth reveals itself eventually at some point. You know, you can't help avoiding it and continuing in that lie. In the next chapter, you talk about the percentage of willing sexual relations that end up in a pregnancy. It was somewhere around 98%. Only, you know, just over 1%, between 1 and 2%, were unwilling in rape cases. Right. And you mentioned the source, and I'll make sure I mention that source in the episode when I bring it up, because that's important. People are always like, well, where do you get your sources? But they talk about it as a parasite. When that's the result of having sex is pregnancy, they'll call it a parasite, because you could, you know, you could enjoy many things and have a bad result out of it that you didn't want out of a good thing, you know?
Right.
And so how is the parasite an improper term to use here?
Yeah, you know, it's, there was an illustration that was commonly used years ago. I forget the name of the pro-abortion advocate that first came up with it, but they talked about what if you had a situation where there was an, I don't know why they used this example, but a violinist who was chained to a person's body, and their survival for the next 9 months and their ability to ultimately go on living was dependent upon some person, and somehow they got attached to that person. Would you say that they are morally obligated to keep the violinist alive And it was a bizarre example, but it was supposedly this very persuasive thing. Well, the problem is we are not every single one of us was at one time in our lives unviable. And every single one of us, viable meaning being able to survive on your own. And every one of us after we were born were still unviable for years. And that's it. So in other words, there is something to say, oh, well, the baby can't take care of itself and keep itself alive until birth. And therefore, obviously, it doesn't have the rights or it's not a full human. But there's a lot of adults who become unviable over time. A child gets in an accident, has a disease, and they're not viable. Even if they don't have an accident or a disease, leave a one-year-old to himself or herself alone, are they going to survive? Well, of course not. They can't. So if viability, for instance, is a legitimate argument in against the rights of unborn children to live, well, they're not viable. They need an adult to take care of them. Well, sure, they're going to need an adult to take care of them for years. Then exactly the same logic could be used, and some people actually have used it, to say, okay, my six-month-old is crying every night, and it's driving me nuts, so I can dump him in, I can put him in a dumpster. I can get rid of him. I can put him to death. And there's actually Peter Singer, Princeton ethics professor, who proposed that children not be declared alive until, I think at first it was 3 months, and then somebody else proposed 6 months. And there's actually states where legislation is being considered in this regard, that you're not declared alive until a certain number of months after birth. And while that sounds bizarre to people, that is just as arbitrary, but no more arbitrary than saying just because they were in the womb and not viable, now that they're outside of the womb and they're not viable, don't we have the same right to kill them?
There's a quote at the end of the chapter, pro-choice claim number 3, that even if a fetus is a person, no person is allowed to live off the body of another person without permission. And you kind of sum it all up at the end. You say this argument for abortion is based on utilitarianism, the idea that whatever brings a person momentary happiness or relief is the right course of action. This is a shaky foundation for any society that hopes to be moral and just in its treatment of the weak and needy. What's, you know, kind of the next step in a society that lives off of the utilitarian mindset?
Yeah, well, there's no end to it. For instance, your parents are elderly. It's taking a lot of money to keep them alive by keeping them, giving them the kind of nursing care that they need. Your inheritance, so to speak, is being eaten up. Of course, they're the ones who earn the money. But even if not, even if it was your own money, there was a time where you would feel the responsibility to care for your aging parents. But if it just becomes a matter of this is inconvenient to me, I was listening yesterday to an audiobook where C.S. Lewis was talking about we have no right to happiness, but he's talking about all the ways that we justify, an adulterous relationship because I have the right to be happy, and where is that written? Where is that? I mean, yeah, there is in the Constitution the pursuit of happiness, but that's not the law of God, and that was never intended to be however I determine that I want to get happiness, because people can pursue happiness through murdering somebody. There's just no end to the utilitarian point of view. I remember years ago, a congressman, I think it was from Colorado, who stood up and said that elderly people have the responsibility to step aside to make way for the younger people. And he was talking about euthanasia. He was talking about ending their lives. My home state of Oregon was the first, not just state in history, but the first principality on the planet to legalize physician-assisted suicide. It was commonly practiced in the Netherlands, but it wasn't legal even there. And the debates that we went through on this subject, people just saying, look, I mean, they're useless. I mean, we've got people who, they've got dementia. Well, that's not a high quality of life. So there's no end. We will be able to, cast aside grandmas and grandpas and people with handicaps. It's a very interesting thing already that we've got going with abortion. You've got TV commercials, and you even had a TV program years ago starring Down syndrome children. They're delightful. They have a higher level, this is empirically proven, of happiness, sometimes by far, than the average child. A delight to be around. Yet the vast majority of people who find out that they're going to have a Down syndrome child killed the child through abortion. And so we've got this, we got the Special Olympics, but if one of those athletes in the Special Olympics, if we'd known they were going to turn out that, quote, special, we would have gotten an abortion. So it really makes us into... It doesn't just dehumanize those who are the victims. It dehumanizes the people who are making those choices. Because if you're willing to do that, what are you not willing to do to another human being?
Absolutely. In chapter 4, you talk about the classroom kind of incident where you bring up a question in a lecture in terms of your on your way to defining pro-choice.
And, yeah.
Could you explain that incident again, or kind of the way you go about that question and answer with the classroom?
Yeah. Several times I've been in front of a class, say high school students, secular classroom, and maybe there are some believers there, but most are unbelievers, and usually the teacher is not a believer. And I say, hey, I've been introduced as pro-life, and that maybe makes it sound like I'm anti-choice, but really I'm not. I am pro-choice, and so I just want to make clear that I'm pro-choice. I believe that I have the right to choose to eat Chinese food or Mexican food. I believe that I have the right to, if I was a woman, I would have the right to get an abortion, take life my child. And I believe that if I'm a man, I have the right to rape a woman because choice is sacred. And I do it with a straight face. And of course, it's outrageous. There's an immediate aghast, how could you say such a thing? Of course, then I say, obviously, I am not pro-rape. I am completely against rape. But rape is something you do with your body. So when we say you have the right to do whatever you want with your own body, we have all kinds of laws that prevent you or will punish you from doing whatever you want with your own body. I mean, public exposure. It goes on and on. There's all kinds of, well, what I want to do with my body is crawl in this person's window and use my hands to steal things out of their house. That's a choice, and it's something I do with my body. And if I have the right to do whatever I want to with my own body, and you have no right to tell me not to. So what I do is take it to its bizarre implications. And then a lot of people, when they hear how bizarre it really gets, then they think twice before they say we have the right to do whatever we want to with our own body. And pro-choice is such an indiscriminate term. Because I will tell people, you're not pro, there's any number of things you're not pro-choice about. Are you pro-choice right now? Yes, I am pro-choice. Are you absolutely pro-choice? Yes, I'm absolutely pro-choice. Great. So if I want to go out and break into your car and remove your stereo, that's fine. You believe in my right to choose that. Well, no. Well, why? Well, no. Because, and then they'll answer it, because you're doing harm to somebody else. Oh, I get it. And that's why I couldn't be pro-choice about rape, because if I was, I'd be advocating a choice or defending a choice that would bring harm to a woman. So if I can demonstrate to you that abortion brings harm to a human being, would you no longer be pro-choice about abortion? And then there's this, well, no, but, you know, because I don't think that it, I said, well, but if I could, would you no longer be pro-choice about it? Because you're not pro-choice about killing two-year-olds. You're not pro-choice about murdering your sister or your neighbor beating his wife to death. So let's be consistent and figure out what we're saying. Pro-choice just sounds so positive, but it's not. You're not pro-choice about everything. In fact, if you are, you are the most immoral person who has ever lived. If you're pro-choice about everything. I mean, most choices are harmless, innocent. The car that you drive, the food that you eat, you know, whatever. If they bring any harm at all, the food that you eat, if you eat junk food all the time, it's maybe going to bring harm to you, but it's not bringing harm to somebody else. But this is a completely different thing when you see that this is a child and this child is dying as a result of an abortion.
Absolutely. And that answers the next question I had was, you know, you can't defend choice on the basis of choice because you make choices every day.
Right.
And so you talk about how you've seen the negative effects of abortion on women post-operation, because people will say it's a freeing thing. A little later, we'll get into the issue of rape and incest, but it's like you can, you know, get rid of the guilt or the shame that comes from that instance by getting the abortion, not having that reminder. But what are some of those effects that you've seen on women post-operation with abortion that are negative effects?
Well, we had a young woman live with us who had had an abortion, and she was pregnant again. It turns out she later told us, a couple of abortions. One was an early abortion. One was a late-term abortion, which is a saline abortion, which was very, very gruesome. And she saw her child being taken out in a bucket from the room at the abortion clinic, and it was a horrifying ordeal for her to go through. But even the earlier abortion, the first trimester abortion, just traumatic. The haunting memories, the sense of loss, knowing that she had lost a child, the psychological effects on a woman, and sometimes the physical effects. Abortion is not always an easy, simple surgery, and the later it is in the pregnancy, the more complicated it can be. And there are many women who, having had an abortion, are no longer capable of having a child. And then they've got the childlessness issue. They've got the guilt issue. They've got the psychological. Many, many, many women remember the exact date. That date was September 14 when they had an abortion, and they remember that date every single year. They don't try to remember it. Nobody puts that on their calendar, or few people would put that on their calendar. They just know. They know that that's an appointment they will never forget. That this is the anniversary, and every year, and then they do the math, my child would be a first grader this year. My child would be an eighth grader. My child would be in high school. My child would be graduating from high school this spring. My child by now would likely have been married and had children, and I would be the grandmother of those children. The psychological impact of abortion is so highly underrated. Every time I hear someone minimize the consequences psychologically and even physically sometimes of abortion breaks my heart, because I know so many women who've had abortions. I've had long conversations with them, not just the girl that lived with us, but many, many others.
A common thing that came up, or theme, that when I attended some of the protests and marches in downtown Asheville was the rights that women have through abortion, and I think the independence that they feel from, in their opinion, what would be kind of a suffocating, misogynistic culture. But you mentioned in your book that abortion actually encourages abuse and control for men who are abusive and controlling. How is that?
Well, think about this. If you have the right to kill, if a parent has a right to kill their child or hire someone to kill their child, and that's what happens with an abortion, if they have that right, right up until the day of birth, then you have become accustomed to thinking you have life and death rights over this child. And under the law, until a week ago, under Roe v. Wade, that's exactly right. You had that right to take the life of that child. Well, once it's established that you have the right to take the life of that child, it means that child belongs to you. And not just, I'm that child's mom or dad, but I own it. It has no rights apart from me. Well, if it's okay to kill a child, to cut a child to pieces through abortion, right up to the day it's born, well, why wouldn't you have the right to smother it with a pillow a week later or a month later? It's the same child. And it's the same helpless child. It's just located outside the womb. That child is no more able to take care of itself than it was when it was in the womb. So if you had the right to life over that child, then why not now? So if it was perfectly okay to take the life of that child, cut it to pieces just a few weeks ago or a few months ago or just a few years ago, what's so bad about slapping that child around now? I'm not even killing it. I'm just abusing it. And notice the use of the term it. Because it's impersonal, even though it already has a gender all along, we treat it as if impersonal while in the womb. And then many men and women feel that same way once the child is born. If I had the right to take the life of that child a few years ago, a few months ago, a few weeks ago, what is different now? And the answer is, logically speaking, there's no difference. A helpless child I had the right to kill. This same helpless child, why do I not have the right to abuse? Once that right is ever recognized as being a right, which it is, or has been, then logically there's no stopping it. So it's not at all surprising that the rate of child abuse rose dramatically from the early 70s forward. I'm not saying it never happened before the early 70s with Roe v. Wade. I'm just saying that after that, the argument that, there will be less child abuse if we have more abortions. Well, first of all, abortion is the ultimate child abuse. Okay, so that's just, that doesn't even make sense. But then, even with all those abortions, not counting them as child abuse, the rate of child abuse dramatically increased. What does that tell you?
Not many nations had allowed abortion before World War II. What changed? What was the pivot at World War II, morally speaking, across the world and within our nation specifically?
Yeah, that's a hard one. Did I address that in the book? I can't recall. If I did, I'm forgetting what I said. But I do know this, that certainly there's incrementalism that happens where once you are desensitized to the value of human life, And how that happened with some people in World War II might be even all of the killing that there was. I don't know what else to attribute to it. If I had said something else, I'm forgetting it.
Yeah, I'm just coming through the chapter real quick to see what you had to say about it. Because that stuck with me. I was really, I mean, obviously, this is pro-choice claim number 6, that opposition to abortion is just a religious opinion. And you talk at length about Nat Hentoff.
Yes.
As an atheistic pro-life advocate. I'm trying to see where you talk about. Oh, there. It's noteworthy that though most governments have long been secular, there's hardly a nation in the world where abortion was legal prior to World War II. This shows that while they may be helpful, religious convictions aren't necessary to believe unborn children's lives are worth protecting. Decent societies have always believed that.
Yeah, so it wasn't really, that was just a kind of a general, the era of World War II. I think the modern society, and I think the modern world as we know it, a lot of people would say began maybe shortly after World War II, and it was part of modern ethics, lower religious affiliation, lower church attendance. That's dramatically more true now than it was back then. But I think that moral societies, regardless of religious convictions, there used to be a universal kind of natural law recognition that there are certain things that are right and wrong. And you can be an atheist, like Atheists for Life. They were my favorite group to come out and stand with us and hold up their signs. They're Atheists for Life, and they're arguing for the right to life of unborn children. And some people were going, why would an atheist believe in the right to life? Well, there are a lot of atheists that believe that human beings have rights, and they are concerned about their own rights, and they're concerned about civil rights for racial minorities. They're concerned about civil rights for women. And just because you don't know God doesn't mean that you have no sense of conscience. The Bible itself in Romans 1 and 2, you know, talks about the conscience and the part that it plays in guiding even the unbeliever who intuitively knows has some sense of right and wrong. And I think one of the worst things that ever happened, one of the horrific elements of abortion in general and Roe v. Wade in particular, was people inventing a right that doesn't exist in the Constitution and, in fact, doesn't exist anywhere. You know, nobody was ever making serious moral arguments for the right to abortion. It was usually the sad situation and a woman didn't know what else to do, and it was tragic. And then you went from that to some people boasting about abortion. We had that in the last several years, certain groups coming forward. And, you know, I have had abortions and I'm proud of it. And it's an attempt artificially to take away the shame of abortion, but it just doesn't work because in people's hearts and minds, they just know it was wrong and it haunts them.
Chapter 7 is the chapter on the rare instance of rape and incest. What is the percentage, and if you remember off the top of your head, the source that you found for that percentage, and then kind of briefly talk about how you walked through that, because you did mention, you know, you talked about punish the guilty, not the innocent, and a pattern of continuation of violence with abortion that perpetuates the violence that started with the rape. And so I just kind of a general question to open the floor for you to speak about it, because that's probably the most challenging one, I feel like, in my opinion, in conversation with people. I don't have an answer often.
Right. Well, the Alan Guttmacher Institute, which was originally founded by and funded by Planned Parenthood, says in a survey of over 1,200 women, 1.5% of abortions reported resulted from rape or incest. Some people think that percentage is significantly lower than that because people have always used that as a way of justifying. Norma McCorvey, who is the Roe of Roe v. Wade, Jane Roe called, Jane Doe. She was, I met her and had conversations with her, and she had reported, and the whole case went forward based on her report of this exceptional case because she had been raped, and she later admitted she hadn't been raped. So you're not going to have a lot of women who will fail to report in an anonymous survey that if they were really raped, they won't fail to report it. You might have some who report it. But in any case, 1.5% is probably the maximum number of abortions that are due to rape or incest. Now, just because something doesn't happen often doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I have a good friend who conceived a child as a result of a rape. And it was a very obviously traumatic situation. But she made the choice to give life to that child. And in their particular case, they adopted the child out because the father was of a different race. And it seemed very conspicuous to them that everybody would know the husband was not the father. And they just decided it would be easier for the child and for us, for somebody else to raise a child. So he adopted into a wonderful home. Years later, she was still, you know, in contact with her child. So very traumatic thing. However, it's not, the rape was not the fault of the child. I am strongly in favor of very severe punishments for rapists. Whenever I hear about a rapist being paroled, I just, you know, as the father of two daughters, that has always troubled me deeply. So punish the person who's guilty, but don't punish the child. What did the child do wrong? If you found out, if anyone hearing this or anyone reading this, you know, found out today, just imagine that you learned, and maybe you learned through the DNA thing and ancestry, or maybe, and that opened up a door and you pursued and you asked some questions. Let's just say you found out that you were conceived as a result of a rape. Would you say, I no longer have the right to live? I don't think you would. Would your spouse who married you, not knowing this, say, I married a person who doesn't even have a right to be alive? No. The horrific thing is not made less horrific by doing a horrific thing that to the child who was born as the result of it. And I think we just, sometimes we project our wrath concerning the horrible thing onto the child. And I've heard people say, no woman has the responsibility or the duty to give birth to a monster. And I go, how is that child a monster? That child's not a monster. You could say the man who inflicted the rape, call him a monster if you wish. Human being is a proper term, but a very, you know, degenerate and immoral and violent human being who did that. But don't talk about punishing the child. I mean, I just think, and I know women, there's a woman in our church when I spoke up years ago. It was I was preaching at our church, a pro-life message in the early 90s. And I said, okay, so I'm going to say some things that are going to be debatable to some of you, but I'm going to argue that the exception clauses for abortion, if you really look closely at them, whether it's for rape or incest or deformity or whatever it is, you just need to look at this and ask yourself, are these really legitimate reasons for abortion? I know they make it extremely difficult psychologically, but I also know that the child is still the child. And I believe that child has a right to live. Woman comes up to me afterwards sobbing. And she said, in all these years, this is the first time anyone has said, I have the right to live. Because I was the product of rape. My mother was raped at age 13. I was placed for adoption. And I was raised by a wonderful family. And I have a wonderful family. And every time I hear people say, well, except for the cause, of course, of rape, you know, because that's a completely different thing. She says, I feel dehumanized. And this is the first time I've heard anyone advocate on my behalf. And by the way, our friend who, you know, placed the child for adoption, she made the comment that child was the only good thing that came out of that terrible incident of rape. And God can bring good out of bad. And certainly a child brought forth, conceived by rape, is the bringing of good out of bad. So it's tragic, but it's not a basis or justification for taking the life. Now, even if it was, then still the other 98, you know, percent or whatever, if you add the deformities, whatever they come up to, but the well over 95% of abortions don't occur for any exceptional reasons. So why would we permit them on the basis of an argument that is not true of them, even if that argument was valid, which I personally believe it isn't?
The last kind of main thing that came up frequently in my conversations was the matter of what people would call a broken and overloaded foster care system. And you know, adoption falls into that category, I think, as well in those people's minds. And so they want to have the abortion for the sake of, just as in, you know, disablement with, you know, Down syndrome or any other disability. The same with the foster care family, that the child will not have a good life. And so you speak in multiple ways about that. And so generally speaking, you know, what's the right response to that from your perspective?
Well, it comes back to the issue of unwanted children. And Planned Parenthood really popularized the arguments against unwanted children, and it had a very popular phrase, every child a wanted child. And I was in a debate one time with a Planned Parenthood staffer who was making that argument, and I said, okay, so first of all, let me say I agree with you 100% with that phrase, every child a wanted child. Now, my question is, how would you finish that sentence? In other words, every child a wanted child, so what? So what is your point? Every child should be wanted. Totally agree. But what's the point you're making from that? Well, then, you know, I actually had a couple of these, and in both instances, I recall, they didn't have an answer. I don't understand what you're saying. And I said, well, here's how I would finish the sentence. Every child a wanted child, so let's learn to want children more, and let's do everything we can to get them into the homes of people who want them. So isn't that the compassionate and even logical response to every child a wanted child? And then I would say to the Planned Parenthood person, since you don't know how you would finish that sentence, let me tell you how you finished that sentence. You say, every child a wanted child, so let's find children who are unwanted and kill them before they're born. Now, you wouldn't say it that way. It doesn't make a nice bumper sticker. Every child a wanted child, that was a popular bumper sticker, but nobody's going to put every unwanted child a dead child. But that's what that philosophy comes down to. Every unwanted child, a dead child. So I remember one time my wife, who 3 months ago went home to be with the Lord, was a pro-life advocate and was at a pro-choice rally. And she was out there. She and I were out there together, and we were having conversations with people. And there was one woman who was holding her pro-choice signs. And that woman very angrily said to my wife, "So, what should we do? I mean, what are you doing about all these unwanted children who are living on the streets and all of this? What are we going to do about them?" Like the pro-life position was responsible for having unwanted children on the streets. If you actually think about it, people who believe the pro-choice position want children considerably less than most pro-life people. But anyway, that's the way of thinking. And so my wife said, "Yeah, okay, yeah, I got it. How about you and I go get some automatic weapons and let's go down to the streets and let's just shoot those kids. Shoot and kill them." And the woman was horrified, and I was a little shocked myself, but it actually ended up being a great argument because, of course, like my, you know, rape argument or whatever, of course, that isn't what she wants. What she's just telling the woman is, logically, if that's true of unborn children, that we shouldn't bring them to the world because they might be unwanted. First of all, you don't know they're going to be unwanted. But they might be unwanted. Well, then why wouldn't we just go kill them now? Well, of course you wouldn't do that because that's not a humane thing to do. It's not what you do to unwanted children. So what you do with unwanted children, the solution is to get rid of the unwanted. Learn to want them more. And there are people lined up, millions of people, awaiting adoptions, particularly adoptions of infants. And who wait and wait and wait. That's why there's a black market for children, you know, and they're waiting forever, but they so want these children. So don't say to yourself, all these children are unwanted. There's lots of people who want those children. But even if they weren't wanted, what would you say of a woman who's unwanted by her husband? What's the solution to that? The solution is to learn to want children more. It's to get rid of the unwanted, not to get rid of the child.
The last thing that came up in conversations with people that I wasn't aware was an argument against a pro-life and towards abortion, but was the issue of overpopulation. I thought it was kind of more of a conspiracy theory based on how this one gentleman was talking about it. Apparently it is a genuine issue. And you mentioned that childbirth is the smallest threat to overpopulation. On the contrary, you know, since abortions have been made legal, overpopulation has been aggravated more, even though there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of children that have been aborted, millions of children that have been aborted since Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. So what are the bigger threats to overpopulation so people are aware of that instead of abortion being the problem?
Well, overpopulation is a very overstated problem. It is true that there are places in the world where overpopulation is true overpopulation in that the resources available, the number of people who are working, etc., don't... you know, it would be better for people to be spread out. But as I point out in the book, they've done studies where, with say 7 billion people in the world, they could all fit into the state of Texas, which I would not recommend, but they'd all fit into the state of Texas and actually with a lower population density than a number of cities in the world today. The point of that is not to say, like, well, that's not a lot of people. It's to say we greatly exaggerate, like there's hardly any space for people in this world. if you fly across this country like I do, and you go from West Coast to East Coast, it's shocking how you can go hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles and see virtually no development down below, virtually no one living in these places. So it's overpopulation. It's the same thing with the resources that are available in the world today. The world is fully capable of producing enough food for every person on the planet. The problem is not that. The problem is issues of distribution, issues of poverty, governments that don't care for their people and have all kinds of red tape that keep certain things from happening. So, but again, even if you thought that overpopulation was a problem. Oh, and one thing I should mention is all the European nations now who are giving financial incentives to people to have children. We will give you this kind of a tax break if you have a child. You know, I mean, people still think about the one-child policy in China, but that's the opposite of most places. What's happening in most places is that they don't have enough people currently working to support the Social Security, Medicare, the equivalent of those things in whatever that culture is, whatever that country is. They need more able-bodied young workers coming into the workforce. And in many cases, there's not enough coming up. And so it's underpopulation that is actually, if you talk to people who understand, underpopulation is a much bigger problem in many nations. I know Germany has those incentives. Singapore has them. Japan has them. And there's several other European countries that have them as well. I think France is one of them. If you want to argue for birth control in the sense of contraceptives, okay, then you could argue for it on that basis. But are you actually going to argue for the killing of already conceived human beings? Look yourself in the mirror after making that argument. You used to be one of those. We all started that way. And we need to be thankful that our parents did not choose to end our lives. And in some cases, people need to be thankful that at the time they were conceived, it wasn't legal to take the lives of children. I always thought that was interesting when I would see older pro-choice advocates arguing for no protection for unborn children, from no protection from abortion, when they were protected by law, when they were conceived. Otherwise, their mother may well have aborted them.
The last thing I kind of want to discuss is the role of people in the same, you know, camp as you that agree with you, that will inevitably be listening to this in large numbers. You know, what is our moral obligation within this? You know, is it even biblically speaking to go to centers on sidewalks and talk to, you know, potential mothers going in to get an abortion? You talked about Proverbs and how it speaks to being a voice for the voiceless. What are the, you know, the roles and the active roles that people can take instead of just engaging in debates?
Right. Yeah. Proverbs 30 says, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Defend the rights of the poor and needy. That can be done in many different ways. One of them is in the public square with debates and articles and social media, using avenues available to us. There are many Christian students who often use my books. I have three different pro-life books, and they often use them for debates in their speech classes. They use them for presentations in their health classes or their social science classes or wherever they're permitted to do so. Then there is just opening homes for adoption, foster care, Foster care is not always this horrible thing as some people think of it as being. There have been some abusive, of course, foster care places, and then there's been abusive homes where adoption has taken place, and abusive homes where just normal conception has taken place. But the point is that foster care can be an incredible ministry. I know people involved in it that love those children and bend over backwards to do all they can to help them. And it's not just about getting easy money. And in most cases, it's not easy money. If you fulfill your responsibilities to take them seriously, it's not. But you're doing something good. Opening your home to a woman who's pregnant, sharing your financial, we did that. Sharing your financial resources. I give away all the royalties from my books, and a significant portion of them, they go to world missions and lots of other things, feeding the hungry, but a significant portion of them go to help needy women who are in difficult pregnancies. They go to the pregnancy resource centers who are there to help women. This isn't about loving babies instead of women. It's loving babies along with loving women. That's an artificial choice. That's a binary trap where it's like people are saying, well, are you going to love the babies or are you going to love the women? So I'd say we as pro-lifers should do all that we can to show love for the women, and also to silence the arguments of the people saying, well, pro-lifers don't only care about babies until they're born, and then they don't care about them anymore. That, for the most part, is patently false. And I'll never forget, and I'll just finish with this one story. I'll never forget standing outside of Portland's largest abortion clinic at a time of great controversy. This would have been in the early 90s. And a reporter from a local television station comes up and got the cameraman with her and all of that, and she comes up to me and she says, okay, so, and they turn it on and they say, all right, so you're out here speaking against abortion. Well, what are you doing personally? What are you doing? So then I was able to say, well, we opened our home to a woman who was pregnant and kicked out of her own home, and we supported her financially, the child, helped get that child into the hands of a family who wanted it. We give a substantial amount of our income to help women in these situations. And I listed some other things. And she signaled to the guy before I was done to just turn off the camera because she wasn't getting the answer she wanted. And then I said, now, if you really want something interesting, and I pointed to a friend of mine over there who was one of my fellow pastors from my church. And at the time, they had adopted 20-some children, most of them special needs children from various countries, disabilities and all of that. And they went on to adopt, more than that. And we and others, ultimately helped support them financially. But I said, he's one of the protesters. Why don't you take the camera over and interview him? And she looks at me and just like kind of rolls her eyes and walks away. Okay, so what does that tell you? It tells you that the stories that the general secular media as a whole are telling are highly selective. They're not going to take interviews with me and with that man when they asked the question. When they get the answer to a question of, I'm not doing a darn thing and I don't have to do anything, it's still wrong. That's what they want you to say, because that's how they want to characterize pro-lifers. So to pro-lifers, don't give them any grounds to characterize us in those ways.
Well, that's all the questions I have. And I say that somewhat facetiously, because that was a lot of questions and you took an hour and a half out of your afternoon to speak with me. So I can't thank you enough.